This is episode 33 of the Great Speech Podcast on The Hill We Climb, the inauguration poem by Amanda Gorman, analysed.
Let's go.
It's a Great Speech Podcast for the public speakers. We're going way down deep to look at what makes a communicator. We'll look at all different topics from the bottom to the top. So get your mind free of all the distractions and please listen up, listen up, listen up.
It's the Great Speech Podcast.
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 Thanks, Dad. So welcome back, my great communicators. How you guys doing? I hope you are well. I am, of course, Kola Relation IK, your communications super skills coach. Reach out to me if you need help on all things communication skills, because that's what I do. But this week, let's move right forward, starting, of course, with the quote of the episode. I have forgotten a few times, as people have reminded me, so I'm not going to forget this time. The quote of this episode is, I've learnt that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And that, of course, is a quote by the great Maya Angelou, the late great Maya Angelou poet, and particularly apt, of course, because Maya Angelou was an inspiration to the young lady whose work I am analysing today. The young lady, of course, being Amanda Gorman, who just pretty much stunned the world last week in her inauguration poem that she delivered at the inauguration of Joe Biden. The poem was called The Hill We Climb. So I will be doing a deep dive analysis into that poem. Make sure, if you haven't already, that you subscribe, click that button and the notification so you will always get this podcast. And remember, I do shout outs to anyone who does a review of the podcast. Gosh, there's been about 30 or so reviews already, which is fantastic. So do feel free to write one and I will give you a shout out in the very next episode. And of course, it helps if you share this podcast with your friends, your colleagues, your network, whether the whole podcast or a particular episode. Do tell other people about it. It helps this episode, this podcast be found, and just kind of is going to make me happy. So I hope you'll do that. Okay, so this is again another one of my kind of dissect a great speech or performance episode. And I have chosen this week the speech or the poem by Amanda Gorman at the inauguration ceremony on the 20th of January of this year, 2021, because it really was pretty much the one thing that universally received wide praise and acclaim at the inauguration. It was a very strange inauguration because of lockdown. You didn't have the crowds, so you didn't have that sense of occasion that inauguration ceremonies, whether in the US or across the world, typically have. So it was a bit of a strange one. And really, apart from Amanda Gorman, there wasn't that much of great note, to be honest. I saw some reports of, yes, Lady Gaga sung well. Joe Biden's speech was fine. I don't find him inspiring as a speaker. I'm not sure he will ever be that. His whole shtick or approach, I think, is just, I'm not crazy, which after the last 4 to 5 years is actually pretty good. But as a result, I think he's just trying to come and lower the temperature as opposed to raise people's emotions and blood even further. So his speech was fine, but it wasn't anything to particularly write home about at all. But the poem by Amanda Gorman certainly was, and was one that many people reference. I was quite unlucky, and this just shows you what world we live in now, that I was on a Zoom call at the time of the inauguration ceremony. So I had it on in the background. I could see it visually, but I wasn't really able to listen to much of it. So a lot of this actually is me seeing the reaction of other people saying, oh, did you see that speech? My wife saw it and was saying, hey, we've got to get our daughter to watch this. I got loads of WhatsApp messages about it. And then I kind of came to watch it myself. And I certainly agree with the sentiment of other people that this really was the standout moment of the inauguration. So let's get into it. So there is a tradition in some respects of performance at inauguration ceremonies to include poetry. The two kind of predecessors to Amanda Gorman were Robert Frost, who gave a reading of one of his poems at the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. It's interesting, actually, because if you watch that inauguration reading by Robert Frost, who's kind of a really renowned poet at the time, it's terrible. I mean, really terrible. Apparently on the day, the sun's glare was in his eyes, so he could not read his own words. So you watch the YouTube footage and he's going, "Ah, sorry, I can't read this. And what does this say?" And eventually he kind of recites it off by heart. So that was Robert Frost on the 20th of January, 1961. That's when he gave his. But the one that probably is most referenced, most well known, and certainly very relevant to Amanda Gorman's performance this year was the inauguration poem called On the Pulse of the Morning, given by Maya Angelou on the 20th of January, 1993. And that poem, it features, in fact, in my top 10 favorite speeches by women, of course. But that was a poem by Maya Angelou. She'd been asked by Bill Clinton at the time to give the speech or the presentation, the poem. And it really was just outstanding and acclaim. And it was partly an inspiration for young Amanda Gorman, who ultimately became this year's poet in waiting, I guess it was, in order to deliver this inauguration poem. Now, although she burst onto the scene with this inauguration poem, like many kind of overnight sensations, she was a long time in making. It's one of those things that I always emphasize to people, is you really want to look at the body of work that people have done that leads to a moment that they grab the occasion on, as opposed to just assuming that they were lucky. So Amanda Gorman, although she is a very young woman, the youngest ever to present at the inauguration, I think only 22 years old, but she's been working for some time. So her work generally focuses on topics of oppression and feminism and marginalization and, of course, race. She already has, I think, a few books out, or at least due to be published very soon. She's written a poetry book. She also is or was the Los Angeles Youth Poet Laureate and was the first national Youth Poet Laureate at the age of 19. So obviously a very accomplished lady. It's interesting, actually, she was reportedly inspired by a speech she heard from another impressive young lady, Malala Yousafzai, the young Pakistani civil rights activist. She heard one of her speeches in 2013, and that inspired Amanda Gorman to become a youth delegate and ultimately to kind of take the path that she has taken. She also studied sociology at Harvard College, which is interesting to hear. And so she'd already kind of been working. She didn't just accidentally happen to be there on the day of the inauguration. And Apparently, it is Jill Biden, that is Joe Biden's wife, Dr. Jill Biden, who had seen her work and had invited her to give the inauguration poem. So that's interesting, actually, because it wasn't Joe Biden himself. Although she and Joe Biden do have a connection in one very real and important respect, which, if you've watched the poem, the inauguration poem, you would not have been able to tell, because I had no idea until I was actually researching for this poem that this was a fact. Amanda Gorman suffers from a speech impediment. She suffers from hypersensitivity to sound, but also, and this is probably the most important part, she has difficulties pronouncing certain sounds, certain letters, in particular, the letter R. Can you imagine that? The letter R. And, you know, if you think, just, I would read something that you have anywhere close to you, right? A book or whatever, and just look at how common the letter R is in the English language. I mean, it's all over the place, right? But she had a speech impediment. She, in particular, struggled with pronouncing the words, or the words with the letter R. And in fact, it's actually her speech impediment that led her to getting into poetry, because she struggled with speaking and articulating her words. She took to basically writing her thoughts, and that's actually what led her to really getting into poetry. She shares that actually in a way with Maya Angelou, who was mute for a number of years as a child before she became obviously an outstanding writer. But Amanda Gorman actually said, and I've kind of looked at some interviews she did, that although she struggled with speaking and didn't really want to do it, she actually figured, and there's a lovely quote that she has, which she said that, if I choose not to speak out of fear, then there is no one that my silence is standing for. That's such a lovely quote. And I think that's so right. If she chooses not to speak, then her silence does nothing for anyone, in particular the people that she wants to stand up for. That always reminds me, actually, of one of my own favorite quotes by Edmund Burke, who was kind of a 18th century philosopher. See, I did politics and philosophy. That's why I'll come out with some of this stuff. But he said, an event has happened on which it is difficult to speak and impossible to remain silent. I love that quote because it kind of emphasizes the obligation, I think, that you have when there is something that kind of captures your mind or your attention to speak out about it. And clearly Amanda Gorman has that same philosophy of life. And so she decided to get into not just writing poetry, but actually delivering and doing spoken word. She would get around her challenges with the letter R by doing things like changing a phrase like "girls can change the world" to "young women can shape the globe," just to kind of take the R's out. And what's interesting, actually, is if you look at the poem that she delivered on Inauguration Day, it is actually very light on the letters R, except for one particular part when it's all R. And we'll come to that when I do my analysis of the poem itself. One interesting thing that I also discovered in kind of looking at this is that in order to G herself up and give her the confidence to go out on stage and to deliver any performance, she has a mantra that she recites to herself that goes like this. I am the daughter of black writers. We are descended from freedom fighters who broke their chains and changed the world. They call me. That's lovely, isn't it? That's really impressive. And she says that this is what she says to herself every time she goes to perform. She'll say that to she'll say that to herself or in her own mind. I think she even does some physical movements with it. And there's a lot of research that shows that that kind of physical act and mental preparation can actually really give you the power that you need to deliver with passion and enthusiasm. Interestingly, that mantra is a little bit of a take on a movie, Moana, where the character does say something similar. And that was penned, or at least the music, I think it was penned by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote and created Hamilton. And that is relevant, as you will go on to see later on. But I do love that mantra. Again, it also reminds me of another one. I was thinking, where have I heard this before, or what does it remind me of? And what I realized, it reminds me of a quote or a passage in the movie Amistad, which is a Steven Spielberg movie about kind of some slaves who try to sue for their freedom in the US. It's not a great movie. I don't think Steven Spielberg does black movies, black topics very well. I'm one of the few who doesn't particularly like The Color Purple, for instance. But let's put that aside. But the quote is, it's said by the lead African character in the movie when they're facing the trial for their freedom effectively. And what he says is, I will call into the past, far back to the beginning of time, and beg them to come and help me at the judgment. I will reach back and draw them into me, and they must come. He was talking about his ancestors, how he's going to call back to the ancestors to help them in that moment. I really like that, actually, because I think it again represents what that principle that Amanda Gorman was talking about, which is you draw on your past for everyone who's gone from you, gone before you, to help you in the moment. Because, as I think is said in the movie, actually, like at that precise moment, I am the entire reason that they ever existed. So I can call on them and they will come. And I think Amanda Gorman had the same principle of they will call me. So there's just kind of a little bit of a précis of Amanda Gorman. Reportedly, although she'd been asked some time before to write this inauguration poem, she only finished it on the night of the 6th of January, which is the night on which supporters of President Trump stormed the Capitol. That appalling insurrection event. But that, in fact, is the thing that spurred her to complete her poem. And you will see some of those themes and how that plays out in her poem itself. She also studied some great speakers like Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass and Winston Churchill. And of course, she comes from the tradition, great tradition of black poets like Maya Angelou and Phyllis Wheatley and people like that, which means she was ready. She was ready, I think, for her moment, for when she stepped up to the stage. One final point about what she was wearing, which I actually emphasize to people that do have a think when you are going to do any kind of communication, especially presentations, about what you are actually going to wear or how you're going to present yourself, because that can indeed have an impact on the impression that people get from you or about you when you are giving your presentation or your speech, or in this case, a poem. So what's interesting is she had a striking kind of sharp yellow coat, Prada coat, apparently, not that I know much about fashion, which the yellow, she said, represented the color of hope and optimism, which is very much a theme to her speech. Was also apparently a nod to Jill Biden, who was wearing yellow when Amanda Gorman saw her in a speech or something, apparently. And then she also had jewelry. So what's interesting is the jewelry that she had on the day was a ring crafted in the shape of a caged bird. That ring was given to her by Oprah Winfrey as a gift when Oprah discovered that she was the one doing the inauguration poem, because Oprah had bought gifts for Maya Angelou, I think some coat and gloves, when Maya Angelou was going to do Bill Clinton's inauguration address. And so Oprah wanted to kind of continue the tradition. And so she reached out and bought this gift of a caged bird ring for Amanda Gorman. And reportedly, that is because the great novel by Maya Angelou, I Know Why a Caged Bird Sings, which is kind of her autobiography, was the inspiration for that particular piece of jewelry. I think she also had earrings that represented something, but I can't quite remember what that was. I'll have to check and see what that was. But so she stepped up to the stage kind of ready, right? She had the backstory. She's incredibly talented. She's kind of struggled in her life to get to the point that she's about to get to. And then she's ready to deliver her inauguration poem, which she had only recently completed. And she steps up to the mic ready to deliver. One little thing before we start hearing snippets, and then I'll give you my analysis of her performance, which just actually really annoyed me, is she calls herself, you know, the skinny black girl. So she's quite slight, quite small. And if you watch the video, the microphones that they used on the day were just quite fat. So they slightly obscured her face, in particular her mouth, which I think is such a shame when you're doing kind of oratory, is like you kind of need to see the full face and the mouth so that you just get a full sense of, you know, the expressions and everything that a performer is giving. So I just didn't like the fact that the microphone slightly obscured her face. So that just annoyed me. So listen, you inauguration ceremony organizers, next time, thinner mics. Okay, so let's hear how she starts off.
Mr. President, Dr. Biden, Madam Vice President, Mr. Emhoff, Americans and the world.
Okay, so that's not part of her poem. It's the preamble that she has used to kind of, I guess, you know, say hello world effectively. Now, you know me, I don't particularly like preambles. I always think get on with what it is you want to say straight away. But I'm fine with this. In fact, the one thing I noticed in this is that she said, Mr. President, that's obviously referring to Joe Biden, who by this time has actually taken the oath. So he is the president. Dr. Biden, referring to Jill Biden. The reason I noticed that is because, I was following American politics around this time, and there was this ridiculous right-wing Fox News story about the fact that since Jill Biden wasn't a medical doctor, then although she had a doctorate, so she was entitled to call herself doctor, she should not use the name because she may confuse people who, you know, if somebody falls ill in a restaurant and calls out for a doctor, they might wrongly think that she's a doctor. You know, one of those ridiculous comments. It's just like, okay, fine. And I just kind of wonder whether her reference to Dr. Biden was just her little kind of nod to Jill, who obviously invited her to give the speech, and kind of knocking those ridiculous statements from others. She references Madam Vice President, which is Kamala Harris, which is relevant because Kamala Harris is the first black female vice president. And I think Amanda Gorman also kind of recognizing and showing her appreciation of that fact as well. Let's continue.
When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade?
So I wanted to stop it there just after the first couple of lines, because that's such a good, strong opening, because it immediately sets the scene with the theme that this is a poem about light in a time of darkness, right? Hope over despair, or good over evil. You know, when the day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? So it's saying that we are in a dark time, or we have been in a dark time in our country up to now. Where can we find the light? And it really sets up what the whole poem is going to be about. And of course, it comes in the context and against the backdrop of that particular dark period, particularly a dark moment of the storming of the Capitol by Trump supporters, which in itself was against a backdrop of what I would suggest is a pretty dark period of his presidency. But that's just my particular opinion. But nevertheless, the main thing is it's a really, really strong opening.
The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. And the norms and notions of what just is isn't always just is.
So, quite a few things going on there. The most immediately notable, I think, was her reference to we've braved, or the loss we carry, a sea we must wade, we've braved the belly of the beast. Brave the belly of the beast. So there are a couple of references there that I think are interesting. The first is a sea we must wade, or into a sea we must wade, which I think I would take that as, so there's a great kind of hymn or spiritual hymn, Wade in the Water, which is sung very much in kind of black gospel churches and was one of those kind of underground railroad songs that were used by those freedom fighters like Harriet Tubman and the like, which reportedly contained secret messages to runaway slaves as to what they should do, you know, get into the water to throw the scent of the dogs off. So her reference to a sea we must wade seems to be a nod back to the heroes and heroines that have come before her as part of the Underground Railroad. But then she says, we brave the belly of the beast. Now, the belly of the beast is a reference to Jonah and the whale. If you know your Bible, as I kind of grew up knowing, the story of Jonah and the whale is really just about Jonah, who kind of lost his way with God, and therefore God effectively and he ended up being thrown into the sea by some other sailors and swallowed up by a great big whale. And he spent, I can't remember how many days, like 3 days or 7 days, in the belly of the whale, known as, in the Bible, it refers to the belly of the whale or the belly of the beast. And that is the origin of it. But belly of the beast has pretty much come to mean a dark place. It's often used to refer to prison, as, you know, where were you? Hey, I've been in the belly of the beast. That's kind of like a dark place. And again, this is referencing the dark time that she is saying the country has been in, the dark place. Belly of the Beast is also an Anthrax metal kind of song. The metal band song. It's also, interestingly, a movie by Steven Seagal, although I have not seen it, so I cannot say that it has any relevance to this. I assume she's not trying to reference Steven Seagal. But it's so interesting that she's really setting up that we're in the belly of the beast, or we've been in the belly of the beast. But she's also showing the lessons that they're starting to learn out of that. So we've learned that quiet isn't always peace. What a great phrase, that being quiet isn't always peace, and the norms and notions of what just is, so the things that we think are just, isn't always justice, i.e. what you may get out of the courts isn't always the same as what we know to be right, which, yeah, as a lawyer I can tell you that is so true. Just because you are right doesn't mean you will win when you get into the justice system, especially the criminal justice system. So it's a very, very good, very, very good opening, really clever establishing of the themes that she's going to expound on during the rest of the poem.
And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished.
So I stopped it there. You heard right at the end that she was just about to roll into the next line, but I wanted to stop it there just for one particular part. But I mentioned the fact she was just about to roll into the next line because that's a real technique of spoken word in particular. So if you kind of have ever been to any spoken word events, part of the technique is almost that you slow down when you're in the middle of the sentence to emphasize the point or of the particular words or passage. But when you get towards the end of the sentence, where ordinarily you would expect a person to break there and give time for the reader to listen and hear and then go on to the next line, there's part of a technique of spoken words where you speed up at that point. So she actually says, a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We the successive of a country, that's what she goes on to say. I wanted to stop it there, but that's a technique you'll actually hear her use quite a few times throughout the poem. And it's really just a technique of delivery that infuses the poem with energy and momentum and makes it feel almost like it's a sermon from a priest who's just lost in the moment and is flowing, you know, with the words just coming from the spirit. But the point that I wanted to make on that last line was this lovely line that somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. And that taps into a very American theme that they have of that they are constantly striving for a more perfect union. That's kind of the ethos of the American Constitution and the American story. And so there's always this idea that even if we have problems and difficulties, we're not broken, we're not dead, we're just an unfinished work. So we're continuing to work on ourselves. And that's, I think, what she was referencing there.
We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president only to find herself reciting for one.
Yeah, so you heard her refer, as I said, she talks often about the fact that she's a skinny black girl. And I think actually she's saying that because she considers that she was a bit of a nerd growing up and kind of very skinny and a bit just kind of, I guess, uncomfortable in that way that young people, certainly I went through it as well, where you just haven't quite gotten a hold of yourself, right? It's almost like if you've ever seen a young giraffe kind of wobbling on its new, you know, tall legs, just haven't quite worked yourself out. You're just a bit uncomfortable and a bit uncoordinated. And she always refers to the fact that she's kind of a skinny black girl raised by a single mother, as that's part of her, I guess, her narrative and her story. And so she talks about that, and she's descended from slaves, raised by a single mother. And the line there of saying that she can dream of becoming president only to find herself reciting for one is very relevant, because in fact, she's very open about the fact that she wants to become president of the country, which I think is a wonderful thing. I love, you know, I love ambition. It's one of the things that I just wish people wouldn't be so, I guess, conscious about hiding. It's good to have ambition. You've got to be humble about it. You can't be arrogant about it, but you should have ambition for what you want to strive for, especially a young girl like this who's been through, young lady who's been through as much as she's been through and overcome the challenges she's overcome. I think it's a great thing. So reportedly, she really does actually want to become president, but it's a nice line to say that I want to become president only to find myself reciting for one. And that's, in a way, the essence of the American dream. Now, one little thing that it's not that I have an issue with it, but I wonder what impact this particular section would have. And that is where she references the fact, her own personal kind of background, that I'm a skinny black girl descended from slaves, raised by a single mother. It works perfectly in the poem, okay? And in a sense, it represents the ideal of the American dream, which is you can come from you know, quote unquote, low background and aspire to be the president, right? But the issue I kind of have with it is that I think if you aren't black, it's quite possible that that particular moment could make you slightly disconnect from the story or from the poem. Now, I am black, so it really spoke to me and it resonated with me. But I just wondered whether actually for others, it might be a little bit of a disconnect to say, oh, okay, all right, well, yeah, no, that's great for you. But it's slightly taking them away from the we as the nation as a whole need to come through this dark moment. So it's not saying that I think that's what will happen or that was the impact. But I just wonder whether that particular passage might have just taken people who don't fall into that particular demographic slightly outside of the moment. She does enough to bring them back in, so it's fine. But I just wonder, that's just me. Hey, you guys, tell me what you think about that particular section.
And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man.
Yeah, so that's where, if you remember, I referenced earlier that she had said some words which represented the Constitution and kind of the ethos of America, which is that they're an unfinished nation still striving to be better. And here she directly says that, you know, we're far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. So we're not, that's not what we're aiming for. We're striving to forge a union with purpose. I like that kind of juxtaposition of the two ideas there, and really trying to emphasize the particular ethos of the country. And of course, that reflects the idea of the union that is perfect, it's a reframing of the words of the Constitution. So the Constitution, the opening words of the Constitution of the United States says, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union." And then it goes on to give all the rest of it. So she's in a sense saying, yes, I know that's what it says, but really the striving to fight to form a more perfect union is actually about forming a union that has purpose. And then she goes on to the first, I think it might actually be the only example of alliteration, which is, and it's one of those ones where when I was at school and I first learned about alliteration, I remember going on a spree for about a month where everything I would write, like, you know, you do creative writing at school, everything I would write, I would put alliteration in because I just thought it was the coolest technique ever. So she uses alliteration in this part, saying to compose. The alliteration is the repetition of a particular sound or a particular letter, of course. So that is to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. So yeah, underused technique there that I personally love. And just, hey, that's poetry, right? So yeah, let's continue.
And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Let the
Yeah, so again, you heard right just at the end where she was going into the next line. That's again that technique, as I said, of instead of slowing down at the end of a line, speeding up. And it gives a real sense of urgency and momentum. But I wanted to stop it there just because I love one of the things that she does throughout this poem, which in a way reminds me very much of speeches by John F. Kennedy, for instance, is taking phrases and flipping your expectations. So John F. Kennedy, of course, would say, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, right? And she uses a similar kind of approach. You know, we're going to lift our gaze not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. Right. You see how she's flipped it there. I like that in particular because I always emphasize with my clients that one of the most important things when it comes to communication is establishing a connection with the people you're communicating with. And I always say, look, if you can, even in a negotiation, if you can, instead of standing opposite each other where it creates that natural adversarial context, actually bring your chair and sit to the side of someone, and then it feels like you're both looking in front of you at the problem you're trying to solve, as opposed to looking at each other thinking that the problem is the other person. So she's emphasizing, look not at what stands between us, but what stands before us. And she also says that we've got to lay down our arms so we can reach out our arms to one another. You know, lovely kind of flipping there. And then finally, we seek harm to none and harmony for all. That's just really clever stuff. You know, it's beautiful. It's. I went back to listen to the poem of Maya Angelou on the Pulse of the Morning that she had given at Bill Clinton's inauguration. And Myers is much more abstract in a way. She talks about the rock by the river and uses that idea to represent the country. This is a little bit more direct, a little bit more obvious, but it still works really well, really well.
That even as we grieved, we grew, that even as we hurt, we hoped, that even as we tired, we tried, that we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division.
Yeah, so she's really warming into the themes now, as you can see. Really taking, what she's doing here is taking the darkness that she kind of opened up the poem about, but showing that she's not wallowing. She doesn't believe the country can wallow in that darkness, but we've really got to find the light and find the hope that is needed. So that's why she said that even as we grieved, we grew, right? Even as we mourned what had happened, it allowed us to get greater. Even as we hurt, we hoped. Even as we tired, we tried. Again, just really lovely juxtaposition of those two thoughts and ideas, flipping it on his head. And then she ends, of course, that we'll forever be tied together victorious, not because we will never again know defeat. And so again, it's not an idealistic vision of the future saying that, you know, everything's going to be perfect now, right? But because we will never again sow division. So it's really focusing not on that we will have setbacks, but we know now, this I think is a nod to what she feels that they had learnt through the storming of the Capitol about the power or the kind of detrimental impact of division that led to the storming of the Capitol. Now, she wrote this, of course, on the night itself, so you can imagine she felt that way. Politics being what politics is, I don't know how much that lack of division is going to last. We'll see.
Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we've made. That is the promised glade, the hill we climb.
Yeah, so this is actually, she references the hill we climb, which is the title of the poem, so I'll come to that part. But let's just deal with the first part, she says, where scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree. So that is, as she said, a scripture reference actually to Micah chapter 4, verse 4, which says everyone will sit under their own vine and under their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. And that passage, interestingly, actually, it was one of George Washington, the first president of the United States' favorite passage. He referenced it over 50 times. And it's meant to represent the primacy of simplicity over kind of royal pomp and ceremony. So sitting under your own vine and fig tree represents that you have gone back to kind of the just being a simple farmer, planting your own trees and plants, and sitting under the and benefiting from the work that you yourself have created. It's kind of against the the pomp and ceremony of the royal court in Britain, which at that time led to the War of Independence. And also suggesting that we are looking to return to a time of simplicity away from kind of aggression and things like that. So that's the reference there to that particular biblical passage. And when she goes on to say the victory will not lie in the blade, but in the bridges that we've made, of course, that is talking about that the progress towards the way the country should be won't be gathered by force, right? So those people who stormed the Capitol are working against the true interests of the country, that actually the true interests of the country lie in tolerance and diversity and ultimately unity, because bridges, you know, building bridges is all about unity, which is really the ultimate theme of this particular poem. In fact, she had said that she had written this this poem kind of, I think she said that her hope was the poem would represent a moment of unity for the country. And that, I think, is really coming through the work that she's doing. I also like the fact that she's prepared to be political as well. You know, she herself had said, I think when she was questioned about why her poetry was so political, she had said that, in fact, the concept or the idea of poetry being non-political itself is rooted in white supremacy. She said, look, you know, the fact that you have the luxury as a white male to write all your poems about being lost in the woods, right, and that you don't have to interrogate race and gender is a political statement in and of itself, right? So she's really saying that poetry for her is political, personal is political, because that's the life she leads. So don't tell me that I have to write about, you know, flowers in the woods, because I don't have the luxury of that kind of life. So it's not surprising that her poem was inspired by her response to the storming of the Capitol, and that she has very real things to say about it. And of course, that particular verse concludes with her referencing the hill we climb. That is the promise to glade, so to clear through the hill we climb. And there, I think, with the hill we climb, she's really referring to, so there's the idea of America being the shining city on the hill, right? It's that idea of American exceptionalism, most notably espoused by Ronald Reagan. Particularly in there's a 1989 speech that he gave that espoused that. And that's the idea of America being different from other nations, and we are the shining city on the hill. So I think the hill we climb, I think, represents the work that all people in America have to do to get to the top of that hill, to that shining hill on the sea, so on the hill, shining city on the hill. So I like the fact that she's talking about the hill we climb, because it suggests that we're not there. When I say we, as in she's talking about Americans, I am American, but that we're not there yet, but we are climbing towards it. And if that's what she meant by it, then I do like that. I like the fact that it is realistic about the faults and flaws, of which there are many in that country, but that nevertheless that they are striving for that perfect union, even if they haven't actually achieved it.
If only we dare, it's because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it.
That little passage there, being Americans more than the pride we inherit, it's the past we step into and how we repair it, I think is possibly a reference there to the idea of reparations and the idea of the original sin of America, as they call it, is slavery. And of course, she's already talked about how she's descended from slaves, and we know about the mantra that she uses as well. So I think the past and how we repair it is basically saying that where you have had difficulties and challenges and faults and problems, part of being American is, it's not just being proud in your country and doing that whole, yeah, USA, you know, and all of that, but it's the willingness to address your faults, address your past indiscretions, your past sins, as it were, and be prepared to deal with them. And obviously that's very much represented in the idea of reparations. And I wonder whether her reference there about how we repair it is kind of a nod to the idea of, in some way, America still has to come to terms with its slavery past.
We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated.
So I have a feeling that if there had been an audience there, because remember, of course, she's delivering this to no audience at all. Normally you would see hundreds of thousands of people in front of that kind of Capitol Hill kind of facade. But of course, there's no one. I think, in fact, they'd planted flags to represent people. So you would probably have got great applause at that phrase that it won't destroy our country. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation, which obviously is referencing what had just happened, or potentially the kind of the whole ethos of the Trump presidency and with its kind of American carnage approach, chaotic approach to politics. But she goes on to say, and this effort very nearly succeeded, but while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. I think that really is referencing that particular moment. I have to say, this isn't my favorite part of the poem, just because it doesn't feel like a poem. It just feels like a statement that a politician would say. I can see Joe Biden saying something like that. I can see Obama saying something like that, right? Can't see Trump saying it. But the point being that it feels less poetic, that particular passage. And that's why I referenced the Maya Angelou poem. You listen to the Maya Angelou poem, that is just entirely poetic, but you still understand the ideas that she's trying to convey. So just a little observation there for me. You may agree, you may not agree.
In this truth, in this faith we trust, for while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us.
So just a reference I really have to give you there. So she starts it with, in this truth, in this faith we trust. I think that's a bit of a nod to the American motto of, in God we trust. But the part that I wanted to reference there was the second part, which is where she says, for while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. Now, for those of you who are Hamilton buffs like I am, I think Hamilton, the musical written by Lin-Manuel Miranda and kind of performed all over the world now, actually, is just one of the most amazing and outstanding pieces of art that has ever been created. It is genius. I've seen it a couple of times, including with my family, my kids. And they loved it as well. We've got the CD. I've got a book on it. Yeah, I'm a kind of Hamilton geeked out. And this particular passage, history has its eyes on us, is a direct nod to Hamilton, because in Hamilton, there is a song sung by the character George Washington in Hamilton called History Has Its Eyes on You. And she loved Hamilton. She has written about the fact that she thought she thinks Hamilton is amazing. In a way, I almost think that Amanda Gorman is kind of the next step beyond Hamilton, because Hamilton was kind of reclaiming US history for people for all people, including people of color who were locked out of that history in a way at a time other than slavery and, you know, that side of things. Whereas in Hamilton, you know, he allows all of the main characters to be played by people of color, and it's done using hip hop and rap, which is a very modern, very urban kind of art form. But by doing it, he's saying, yes, this nation and the founding fathers belong to all of us, including the people that were locked out. And in a way, Amanda Gorman, this young, skinny black girl descended from slaves, now reciting at the presidential inauguration, is kind of a logical extension of what Lin-Manuel Miranda meant when he was doing Hamilton. Interestingly, Lin-Manuel Miranda commented, I think, on Twitter about this performance, saying it was brilliant. And Amanda Gorman tweeted back to him saying, did you catch the Hamilton reference? That sounds like a conversation that's going to continue. But yeah, lovely little passage there that I liked.
We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burdens. But one thing is certain. If we merge mercy with might, and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright.
So you can see that she's really kind of really going into full on into her themes. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, that seems to me to be trying to say, America, we're better than what we have been over the last 4 years, when the ethos of President Trump was really very much about that kind of macho might is right kind of approach to life. Well, here she's saying, no, you've got to merge mercy with might, and then might with right. Not that might is right, but you've got to make might, put might with right. And then love will become our legacy and change our children's birthright. And I feel that that change message is kind of hearkening back to the kind of first campaign of Barack Obama when he first became president, when his theme very much was about change and bringing change to the country. And so now she has really warmed up, and now she goes into kind of the, I guess, the most energetic part of her passage, of her poem. And listen out, you're going to hate me for this, but I'm going to say listen out now, because I think you may be able to hear the challenges she has with forming the letter R. I'm not being unfair to her. The reason I say it is because you will notice that this is the first passage where she really does use the letter R repeatedly, but there's a particular reason which I'll tell you about after you've heard this particular passage.
So let us leave behind a country better than the one we were left. With every breath from my bronze pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the west. We will rise from the windswept northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked south. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid.
Wow, so you can hear that, right? Just listen to the cadence and the momentum and the energy that she gives behind this particular passage. You know, will every breath from my bronze pounded chest, we will raise this winded world, we will rise from the golden limbs, we will rise from windswept northeast east, we will rise from the lake rimmed cities of the midwestern states. You can hear the power. We will rebuild, reconcile and recover, right? So you see what I'm hearing about the R's. You may have heard it in there. So why does she do that? Because, you know, hey, if you struggle with R's, the last thing you want to do is to use that particular phonetic sound in the climax to your performance. But I think, in fact, that is a direct nod to one of the most famous poems of Maya Angelou called Still I Rise, which is a fantastic poem, in particular, a poem of kind of female empowerment, where Maya talks about how you may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may tread me in the very dirt, but still like dust I'll rise. And that whole, and the whole poem continues with that still I'll rise theme, kind of saying you will never you kind of break me down. So I think the whole that particular passage clearly references the famous poem of her idol, Maya Angelou, Still I Rise. That's why she says, we will raise this wounded world. We will rise, we will rise, we will rise, we will rebuild. Echoing a similar refrain and approach by Maya Angelou. So it really was the crescendo of her speech and of her passage. But then as it leaves, kind of moves beyond the R's of rebuild, reconcile and recover, then she goes into talking about every nook and cranny, every known nook of the nation, every corner of the country, our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered. I have a feeling, I think that that in itself echoes the I Have a Dream speech of Dr. Martin Luther King in 1963, because in kind of the crescendo of his speech, Martin Luther King references Let Freedom Ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado and from the curvaceous slopes of California. I can't do Dr. King's accent, right? But the point is, he references the different parts of the country. And if you ever listen to my analysis of the I Have a Dream speech, you'll remember that I talk about how he does that to kind of bring together all of the country. So I'm not leaving any part. I'm talking about Colorado to California to Georgia to Tennessee to Mississippi. And where she talks about every nook of our nation and every corner called our country, I think she's also using that same principle or that same technique of bringing and talking about everyone and saying that all of us are part of this great nation that we call America. And so she moves to her ending, which is the most, from the, all the kind of references I've seen, this is the most repeated one, which is the kind of the end of the poem.
The new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
Yes. Oh, man. Listen to how sparse that audience sounds and the applause that are kind of like just a few hands clapping. It certainly did not represent the poem had received a meager response, right? Everybody loved it. It just represents the fact that there was, you know, it was socially distancing, right? So there was hardly any people there. But what a great ending to really a fantastic poem. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it. You know, that in a way I had kind of expected her to end it there, because it's kind of, yeah, you know, if you search for the light, you will see it. And that's very often the way people think about the idea of hope. It's about looking for inspiration somewhere. But she goes beyond that with the final line, if we are only brave enough to be it. And that, for me, captures the essence of that idea that I think I first heard with Gandhi, certainly was referenced by Martin Luther King and Barack Obama as well, which is we have to be the change that we want to see. So Wade says that there's always light if only we're brave enough to be it, is saying that we have to be the light that we want to see in the world. We've got to be brave enough to be that. Interestingly, the day after I watched her on CNN being interviewed by Anderson Cooper, and Anderson Cooper recited this line, and she did a pretty good job about it, but it's clearly the line or the passage that most people, when they have thought about this poem, have referenced. And I think it's excellent, excellent way to end. And she kind of, you know, nods and says thank you and walks off to great acclaim. And her life has changed since then. When I emphasize to people how a great speech or great piece of communication can change both the world and your life, this is a perfect example. Her book has gone through the bestseller list. She's now being feted and kind of celebrated all over. Her life will never be the same again. And more power to the young lady. She fully deserves it. This was an excellent, excellent piece of communication, an excellent poem, excellent delivery, excellent presentation all round. Communication has the power to change the world and to change your life. This is a perfect example of that truth. So, long one today, but I hope you appreciate my deep dive, dissect analysis of this poem. It's the one that I had the most comments on from people or comments about. So I really felt that I had to do an analysis of it. If you agree, disagree, love, hate, or are indifferent to what I've said, either way, do let me know. Send in some comments. Let me know kind of what you think. And that is it for this week. We're on the Great Speech Podcast. I will be back most likely with an interview the next episode, just kind of give you something a little bit different. But I hope you like this. I shall say ciao as my goodbye in a different language, just because I didn't prepare which language I was supposed to use, and that's the only one that comes to mind. I'm pretty certain I've used it before, but hey, don't kill me. I'm trying my best. All right, guys, ciao. See you next episode.